the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome back. And if you're a new listener, I want to let you know that this is a two-hour show in which we try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. In the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics, instead focusing on the issues that underlie politics and current events. Issues that affect us all, young or old, locally and globally. Then in this, the second hour, we balance the creative with the intellectual by featuring in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. And remember, if you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all the past shows there, and you can connect with me on social media should you wish. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing William Finnegan, award-winning literary journalist and narrative non-fiction author. After acquiring a BA degree in literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and studying for an MFA in creative writing at the University of Montana, William spent 4 years abroad traveling in Asia, Australia, and Africa. His experiences led to his first book, Crossing the Line, A Year in the Land of Apartheid, published in 1986 and selected by the New York Times Book Review as one of the 10 best nonfiction books of the year. This whet his appetite for political journalism. A highly regarded war reporter and literary journalist, William has written for many publications, including Mother Jones and Harper's, and has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1987. He's received many journalism awards, including twice receiving the John Bartlow Martin Award for Public Interest Magazine Journalism, given by Northwestern University's Medhill School of Journalism, the Edward M. Brecker Award for Achievement in the Field of Journalism from the Drug Policy Foundation for his article Deep East Texas, a Citation for Excellence from the Overseas Press Club for his report From Sudan, The Invisible War in 2000, and the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism for his article Leasing the Rain on the Fight to Control Fresh Water. In addition, he has received 2 Overseas Press Club awards since 2009. He has written 4 books in addition to his debut: Dateline Soweto, Travels of Black South African Reporters, A Complicated War, The Harrowing of Mozambique, Cold New World, Growing Up in a Harder Country, which deals with the bleak lives of American teenagers in spite of the United States' economic affluence, and the newly published Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life, a memoir which is described by the reviewer at the Los Angeles Times as a book about a surfing life, also about a writer's life, and even more generally, a quester's life, more carefully observed and precisely rendered than any I've read in a long time. Welcome to the show, William.
Thank you, Ruth.
So you've been a writer nearly your whole life. I'm wondering, do you remember the first piece of writing that consciously had an impact on you?
Do you mean as a little kid?
Sorry?
Do you mean as a little kid?
Yeah. I just wondered, curious.
Yeah, no, I was a great consumer of girls' novels when I was a little boy.
Oh, interesting.
Heidi and Pollyanna and all those sorts of books.
Oh, interesting. What appealed to you about that?
I don't know. I was later embarrassed when I realized these were all girls' books that I dearly loved.
Good stories and very human interest stories, I would say, too, probably involving more emotion than perhaps just an action book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I also was crazy about sports books and some of the usual, you know, Hardy Boys and Tom Swift fare.
Uh-huh, yeah. Oh, interesting. So when did you first begin writing yourself?
I probably started writing stories when I was a small kid, too. It was really what I always wanted to do. I kind of compulsively curious and always trying to fit things into a kind of narrative that I can make my own, I suppose. I wrote fiction, though, primarily when I was a student, and even through most of my 20s, I wrote 3 novels, and really thought that's what I would do, although I didn't have anything you could call a career plan. And you mentioned in your introduction quite accurately that I was sort of bumming around the world surfing after grad school and landed up in Cape Town, South Africa, where I got a job teaching in a black high school. This was during the bad old days of apartheid. And it was quite a transforming experience to be in the middle of that. The students went on strike that year, and it turned into a major confrontation with the apartheid government. And I kind of came out of South Africa after a year or two there with quite changed priorities. I mean, I had arrived as a fiction writer and basically left as a political journalist, which is what I've mostly done ever since.
And what appeals to you about writing about real events, you know, being the political journalist, rather than perhaps taking inspiration from those events and then writing fiction about that?
Well, I was, as I mentioned, I was in the thick of this very intense experience in South Africa, in this township outside Cape Town. And I was just finishing a novel then about people working on the railroad in California, which I had done before I left the country. And it just began to seem really kind of, I don't want to say la-di-da, but disengaged from these incredibly urgent things that I saw around me, where I first had a kind of fundamentalist view. You know, what can I do to be useful? What can I write? I mean, I wasn't a trained journalist. I was very much in deep sympathy with the anti-apartheid struggle. I mean, did not approach this as an objective reporter. So I sort of had to find my way, and at first didn't really even write about South Africa, but was, and I've been reading a lot of narrative nonfiction. I mean, some of the writers I loved, I mean, George Orwell, for instance, I preferred his nonfiction to his fiction, and I had sort of seen the literary possibilities there right along, but had not really felt like I had the material or the wherewithal to do that, and loved fiction more. But there was just something kind of scarifying about this time in the middle. It was a lot of violence and just intense political conflict, and fiction just felt inadequate to the task of expressing what I'd seen and what I wanted to now get out in the world. Also, practically speaking, I wasn't making a living writing fiction. These were, you know, unpublished novels.
Yes.
And so I started freelancing and took a sort of private vow to stop having, I'd had a lot of day jobs like teaching high school, and that I was now going to make a living from writing, which really meant doing, you know, freelance journalism. That was the only way I could have a hope of making a living, and I sort of scraped by for years doing that. But as I said, my interest really became sort of power and politics and, you know, social justice struggles, and fiction just felt, well, I think I wasn't good enough at it, really, to feel like I was really going to produce anything that grabbed people and made a big difference.
Right. I mean, it sounds like from what you're saying, the things that you were seeing around you, you wanted people to realize that they were really happening and expose that in a way.
Yes, but this funny thing happened because I had this kind of utilitarian fundamentalist view. I was in the thick of it, and really the idea of writing for American magazines, say, about the anti-apartheid struggle as I was seeing it in action around me, was, I considered it and talked to some of my friends and colleagues there in South Africa about it, and decided against it. I mean, it was kind of grotesque to me. I mean, I've been out of the U.S. for a few years, and I would pick up magazines and when I could find copies of American magazines that I liked, and would look at them and try to picture articles about South Africa in them, and the sort of suffering of the black majority and the struggle. And I would just think, no, I do not want to entertain whoever the readers of this magazine are with tales of you know, oppression from here. They're not going to do anything about it. It's not going to do any good. Mm. Which is a pretty severe test, you know, to for what's worth doing. You know, they're not going to do anything, and I meant, you know, materially, they're not going to help. Mm. And so it took me quite. So I instead started freelancing and doing increasingly political journalism, but sort of other topics, not South Africa, because I had this kind of activist view of what was going to be useful in South Africa. And I came back to the U.S. and eventually, you know, got over some of that and realized that this was really the story I had to tell. Mm. I'd been there. I did have things that and whether people were going to, you know, jump up and write a check to the ANC, you know, the leading liberation movement at the time, the African National Congress, or not, it was still, you know, what I had to contribute with some, you know, testimony and some stories, and eventually wrote that book, Crossing the Line.
Yeah. It was selected as one of the 10 best nonfiction books of the year. That must have been pretty affirming for your first book.
Yeah, it was really well received, and by then I was still involved in the anti-apartheid movement as a sort of writer by that point, but I wasn't holding it to this you know, strict test of, you know, what you know visibly can it contribute, and yeah, I was really pleased by all the, you know, attention it got and the people who read it, and it was about teaching high school, so I think a lot of students, maybe more college students, but also high school students could relate to it, so it got out there and was pretty widely read.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it must have been very different to read about that experience, very contrary to the experience of being in America for young people.
Yeah, and Britain, it was a British edition. And yet I got a lot of, I mean, out, you know, speaking about South Africa in the wake of that book in particular, I got lots of reactions, particularly in, like, inner city audiences, people saying, yeah, okay, all this is going on. What about apartheid in this country?
Mm.
And that sort of thing. And I would inevitably say, it's pretty different, and try and sort of lay out the differences. But the point was well taken, that it was, I wrote a couple of other books about Africa after that one and during that period, and gone to work for The New Yorker. So I was reporting big pieces for them in South Africa and Mozambique and writing about Southern Africa. But I was quite aware of, as I say, the sort of the truth in that tough question, which is, you know, it's quite easy for you as this white American to write about racial oppression in Southern Africa. You know, why don't you tackle something closer to home where you're more implicated? And ultimately I did. My next book was an American book and looking at sort of downwardly mobile communities, starting first in inner city in New Haven, Connecticut, and I was kind of pushed by people who'd read my South Africa stuff to turn my eye to subjects closer to home.
Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, award-winning literary journalist and narrative nonfiction author, William Finnegan. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
The music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
About you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's for
It's a Question of Balance music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, this is Jackie from Integrity Event Planning. Are you coordinating an event? Don't know how you'll get it all done? Stop sweating the small stuff. We plan everything from family events to fundraising and corporate events. Contact Integrity Event Planning for your next event. Check out our website, integrityeventplanning.com. Integrity, it's what sets us apart. With 16 years of experience, we negotiate with your bottom line and needs in mind. So sit back and relax and let us serve the champagne. We've got this.
For your next event, visit integrityeventplanning.com. That's integrityeventplanning.com.
Dream, baby, dream.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, William Finnegan. And I do want to let you know that William is going to be at the Santa Cruz Mountain Brewing Company on July 28th at 7 p.m. as part of Bookshop Santa Cruz's series of combining a love of books with a love of beer. He's going to be talking about his new book, which we're going to be talking about a bit later in the interview. So if you want to meet William in person, that's July 28th. 7 p.m. at Santa Cruz Mountain Brewing Company, and you can find out all the information about that at bookshopsantacruz.com. Well, before the break, William, you were talking about how writing about oppression in South Africa. You then went on to look at that similar, perhaps, oppression in America. I assume you were talking about your book Cold New World, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So, what was it like writing, about that kind of thing going on in America, your own country versus South Africa?
Yeah, well, it was quite different. I mean, I by then was a journalist and had been working as a journalist for some years, and not just somebody who happened to find themselves in the middle of a newsworthy situation. So I had, sort of notions going in about what I wanted to do in different places. I ended up writing about four downwardly mobile families and kind of teenagers in those families or young adults. And I started in the inner city of New Haven, Connecticut, which is the home of Yale University. So you had this very strong contrast, very poor city with this incredibly rich great university. And I ended up writing there about a 16-year-old African-American boy who was working on the street as a drug dealer, and I had strong ideas about how to approach or structure that kind of piece, not wanting to do it as a crime story or anything like that, but as a sort of political story. And so that sort of directed my reporting and complicated my reporting. And I then went down after I finished that one. It actually came out in the magazine first and in another form. And then I went down south to the Deep South, where lots of African-American families sort of have their roots before what's called the Great Migration, people moving north for jobs in the 20th century, and look for a kind of counterpart community, counterpart family to this northern urban community I've been writing about, and so on. Just kind of followed my stories onto what seemed like the next step. I ended up in California for the last one, which was about some white kids in a kind of downwardly mobile suburb of Los Angeles called the Antelope Valley. There were some racist skinheads and some anti-racist skinheads having this kind of gang warfare, and they kind of completed this rather grim picture of parts of the economy, and this was through the 90s, in a kind of boom period. The economy was growing. through most of the Clinton presidency, but it was there were big pockets that were, and the income inequality has only increased since, that were headed in the other direction, and that was what I was trying to write about.
I mean, how much do you feel things have changed since you wrote that book? Because in some ways things have changed, but in a lot of ways it seems that that they've just not moved forward in the way that perhaps we would have hoped.
Yes. It, well, the whole economy obviously sort of tanked in 2007, 2008, 2009. Large parts of the country still haven't recovered. I mean, good jobs were going away. That was part of the story I was writing about, and they haven't come back. And the various communities I wrote about it, I mean, there was the sort of crack epidemic in the 90s. I was partly writing about that changed, combination of, you know, policing and public health and just the sort of social constellation around that. And yet some places are very much as they were when I was writing about them. Even more kind of social and economic problems. So it's not a kind of prognosis that I mean, I'd be happy to come up with a more upbeat analysis of where American politics and the jobs economy, the sort of real economy as opposed to the financial economy, is going. But I don't really see it.
I think also perhaps something that you've brought up in this book is something another guest I've had on the show, a really good rapper called Merce, has sort of brought up, is that these sort of pockets, you know, like in LA where he was from, they're really, I mean, he says it's like a war, like any other war. And, you know, a lot of people are suffering from PTSD, the people who are having to deal with this kind of violence and death on a daily basis. And yet there's this sort of glamorization of gang culture by a lot of people, you know, within that community as well. But I think it's interesting. I'm just thinking of your two books. We tend to think of conflicts in other areas, other parts of the world, very differently to these conflicts that are actually going on within our own country.
Yeah, as I said, I was kind of prodded. I continued to do a lot of foreign correspondence, war reporting, and other long pieces for The New Yorker, interspersed with the reporting I've done in the U.S. But as I say, I was sort of prodded by Americans to you know, have a hard look at some similar, I mean, issues of racism and as you say, sort of virtually, you know, sort of wartime trauma going on in some communities, and I agree that it's hard to grasp if you're in a more sort of peaceful part of this country, so to speak, you know, in a stream in which you're not exposed to lots of tension in the streets and you know, unhappy relations with the police and gang control of some areas. Hard to grasp what that means. I think the past year or so, with these sort of eruptions of egregious police misconduct and the protests in Ferguson, and I was starting with the case in Florida, and then this whole series of, you know, police killings and protests and the Black Lives Matter movement, you're actually getting people saying, try to imagine what it is. This is, you know, basically addressed to the white majority or anybody who isn't close to this sort of lived African-American experience, which is not so different from how it was, you know, pre-civil rights era. Well, everything changed then. Well, it changed quite a bit, and it changed a great deal for some people. But the pain and pressure that comes with being, you know, of color in this country, particularly African American, hasn't changed, and that's kind of elided by a lot of popular entertainment and sports and so on, but it remains the case.
Yeah, it's interesting what you were saying about it's hard for people to imagine, and I guess this is where kind of narrative nonfiction can be so useful, and I was reading an article by award-winning journalist Deborah Campbell called Can Journalism Be Art? And she says, roughly speaking, this literary form combines traditional reporting, interviewing, research, visiting the scene with the techniques of fiction writing, having a voice, scenes, characterization, dialogue, metaphor. It can be first person, but doesn't have to. It cares about the writing as much as the research, and the two are inseparable. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this blurred genre, as the Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuscinski called it. Does it feel like a blurred genre to you, or does it feel natural to write nonfiction creatively?
I quite agree with many points made in that quote, and it does come quite naturally to me, this blurred genre, as Kapuscinski called it, in that, as I say, I wasn't trained as a journalist. I sort of came up as a fiction writer and then turned to journalism and do some fairly newsy, you know, lots of political journalism. But basically write long form, and one does use all the techniques of fiction except for making things up.
Right.
you know, scenes, dialogue, and all that. And if we're talking about the particular genre of writing about poverty and what it's like to be poor in the United States, for instance, I mean, I certainly approach that as an outsider. You know, I'm this college-educated white guy, and so there are all the sort of power dynamics under that, which need to be, and the sort of space in which you can do that writing persuasively has really, really narrowed over time. And so you need to very much acknowledge your position and those power dynamics between the people you're interviewing or writing about and yourself, and kind of hand over the narrative rights, as you were, the authority to tell the story, the right to tell the story, as much as possible to the people in the story. You know, take, you know, the kind of indigenous analysis seriously. Don't just sort of contradict it with what you bring to the situation. And that ends up being part of the story. You know, you can't avoid, if you're avoiding that part, you're a little bit living in a kind of somewhat colonialized, almost fiction world, because there is the situation of reporting that always has to be understood and dramatized too.
Yeah, it's interesting with you saying that. It's making me think of kind of, it's almost like the difference between quantitative and qualitative research. You know, when you do qualitative research, the feelings and the input of the researcher is very important and is actually part of the research. Whereas when you do quantitative, everything's supposed to be clinical and the researcher shouldn't be involved at all. And it seems to me that's almost the distinction with the kind of literary narrative journalism is there is that kind of some reflection of what the journalist is bringing to the story as well, would you say?
Yes, it's a good analogy, and some reflection of the limitations of your perspective. I'm not here to, you know, sort of anthropologize among the natives and tell you what's what. I'm here trying to understand what's going on. Here's what people are saying. Here's how people understand their situation insofar as I've got them to tell me. And none of this is definitive. And as I say, it's a good analogy between qualitative and quantitative research. The quantitative is fairly discredited, let us say, in narrative nonfiction.
A lot of your writing centers around areas of social justice. What makes you want to tell a story? I know when you were in South Africa, you were there and the story sort of came to you. You've said subsequently, you know, you're choosing more, or perhaps in some instances being given assignments. But are there common criteria, or does each story, you know, have a unique draw? And what is it that draws you?
Certainly every story has got its own kind of reason for being and energy that drives it, but a common thread with me has often been some kind of outrage about what seems to be going on, and also sometimes a sort of mystery. I mean, maybe even a news story that is heavily covered, but seems to me to have a kind of center that I'm never getting, and we'll never really know unless I go there and spend time. And so often I've even in war reporting in the Balkans in the 90s or Central America or Southern Africa, Sudan, different conflicts I've covered, I've often thought, you know, I don't really understand what's going on there, and the standard narrative's not really telling me. Mm. And then I go and spend time, and something begins to become clear, and it's so there's a sort of mystery about a story, you know, not necessarily outrage. I mean, often in wars, for instance, you can't find any good guys. You can be outraged on behalf of civilian victims, but usually between armies, there's not a lot to choose. Say that sweepingly, but in many of the cases, many of the places I've looked at, and then it becomes just trying to get to the bottom of things as a kind of motivation, and that goes for all kinds of stories. I just did a piece in the Peruvian Andes. I was looking at illegal gold mining in a very high elevation sort of boom town, and I was just trying to understand what goes on there. I'd read a bit about it, but what I read turned out to not be worth much, and the kind of labor system, these indigenous miners digging incredibly dangerous conditions, really, really difficult, cold, not much oxygen, hard rock mining, and how did it really work? Why were people really there? That kind of stuff is you know, it just kind of draws me into it. I have this compulsive curiosity. I want to know.
So, right.
As you say, every story is different.
Yes, yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, William Finnegan, award-winning literary journalist and narrative non-fiction author. We'll be back after these messages. Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, William Finnegan. And I wanted to remind you again that William is going to be at the Santa Cruz Mountain Brewing Company on July 28th, 7 p.m. as part of Bookshop Santa Cruz series of combining a love of books with a love of beer. So you can get more information about that if you're interested in meeting William in person and hearing him talking about his new book, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life, which has been described as a memoir of an obsession, a complicated enchantment. So to people who don't surf, the allure of surfing is mysterious and somewhat inscrutable. William, I'm wondering, did you have any sense of wanting to convey some of the surfing magic to non-surfing readers?
Yes, I like your word, inscrutable. I did. I mean, the book's very much written for the general reader. I mean, it's easy to talk about surfing between surfers, you know, right, for other hardcore surfers, but it's incomprehensible or inscrutable to everyone else. Then again, you don't want to sort of bog down your story with lots of, you know, with a glossary and lots of technical descriptions. So I've tried to sort of split the difference there. And the book's not all surfing by any stretch. It's sort of the story of my life told through surfing. It's memoir. Hoping to make clearer to people both what surfing is and what it isn't. I mean, it's not very well described as a sport. You know, it's just, if you get into it, it's sort of hard to do not seriously. I've had this very intense surfing life for, God, 50 years now. A lot of quite vivid friendships form around it, and you end up bending your life to it in many ways. And it's this, with me, it's involved a lot of travel, a lot of looking for waves. Mm. Sort of years of my life spent chasing waves all over, you know, the farther corners of the South Seas and Southeast Asia and so on. So I read about that and also kind of why do this? And it's hard to distill, but I mean, it's really the pursuit of this particularly kind of drenching experience of beauty, I want to say, beyond anything that you associate more, you know, more commonly with sport. And then how one fits that kind of obsession, as you called it, or somebody just called it, into you know, a life, work, family. You know, I call it the Barbarian Days because in my kind of bipolar life, surfing very much represents the North Pole of you know, irresponsibility and you know, nature worship and you know, just worship of strange gods, and yet I also have this other side that wants to be a, you know, a citizen, and wants to, in the ancient sense of the word, wants to be a, you know, be productive and useful and well write and inform my readers and, you know, have opinions and that sort of thing. And so there's all that tension, this sort of struggle to achieve responsibility, and then this struggle against responsibility. And I hope that before it's over, I mean, a lot of the reviews suggested that reviewers who don't surf feel swept up into it and you know, and enjoy the story and see the whole business quite differently.
Yes, yeah. I don't surf, but one of the things that I have sort of understood about what is attractive about surfing, and you can say whether this is true or not, is that there's a lot of downtime in surfing when you're like waiting for waves. And so there's this almost kind of, I don't know if spiritual is the right word, but sort of sense of being out in the ocean with, you know, sharing this experience with people. And that's part of the mystery that I sort of talked about, that inscrutable part as well, you know, not just why you surf, but also those moments in between the waves, what is going on then?
Oh, yeah, there's looking for waves, not having anything to surf, and sort of chasing them around and trying to figure out where they're going to be and when. And then there's surfing itself. It's not, you know, skiing where you ride a trail up the mountain and you're on your skis. It's you've got to go out and sort of find the waves when they come and be in the right spot at the right time. And there's a lot of waiting, as you say. You share with other people perhaps, or you're on your own and just trying to tune into what the ocean's going to do. And it's really, there's this, I think people don't surf, you sort of glance down the end of the street, see some people out in the water and assume they're they're playing, they're messing around, which is true. But really what everybody's engaged in is this ongoing effort to understand, you know, to read waves, to understand what's going on in at your local spot, say, in that little tiny, very, very specific patch of ocean, you know, what every current, every eddy, every degree of tide, wind, swell direction, down to very, very subtle kind of ineffable factors that can barely be explained, trying to understand what it all means and what it means about what the ocean's going to do and how you're going to react. It's pretentious to call it, I suppose, the intellectual work of surfing, but everybody is engaged in that all the time.
Mm.
And at the more complex surf breaks, that's, you know, a lifetime's work to try to understand this wave. I mean, this reading of waves is far more important, really, than riding them. And, I mean, if you read them well, you'll ride them well.
Mm.
And so that's going on. People are sitting out there, but they're trying to process what's happened that day and 20 days similar and 200 other days slightly similar at this very spot and what is going to happen next and be in the right spot at the right time.
Yeah. You've covered such serious, often harrowing topics in your writing. I'm wondering how surfing figures in your life in that sense, whether there's any sense of it providing coherence or a sense of balance.
Well, sometimes it's a real break. I mean, I have written about a lot of quite dark subjects, you know, war and other kind of harrowing situations to write about, and surfing has sometimes been very directly a break. You know, I've been in the Civil War in El Salvador, and horrible things happened, and I, you know, file my piece and then just go surfing and try to get out of my system somewhat this sort of poisoned feeling. Mm. So there's that. There are actually a fair amount of analogies, though. There's surfing bigger waves, which, you know, is often a sort of test of nerve and involves a lot of kind of sobering judgments about what's safe to do and what's not, and what to do when things go bad.
Mm.
Some of the reporting I've done involves some similar fears and you know, tight judgments.
Mm. You start your new book, Barbarian Days of Surfing Life, with you moving to Hawaii and starting eighth grade at a school which is very tough. I was wondering, what made you begin the book there?
I don't know. It's chronologically, it's not really the right spot. I'd been surfing a couple of years. I mean, so this isn't like, you know, first time I went surfing or you know, or I was born, and it's just in medias res there. I'm in this school, lost and getting pushed around.
Mm.
And then I had to, in the second chapter, sort of back up and fill in behind that. So it wasn't the most obvious structure, you're right. but it, I don't know, when I sat down to write this book, which had been sort of years in mulling and discussion, and I should write this, but do I really want to, sort of thing. And finally, maybe 10 years ago, sat down and started seriously writing it between more journalistic jobs and projects. I very much wanted to start there. I mean, I think I wrote the first line in longhand when I sat down to write, and it was just, you know, how to structure a long piece of writing, a book or a very long magazine piece. There's a lot of sort of narrators or storytellers' intuition about it.
Mm.
You know, a place where you can kind of grab people's interest at the top, but also it feels like a solid foundation for everything that's to follow.
Right.
Those first few pages don't have anything about surfing. They're just about, you know, being in this strange school and how I got there. And then they kind of segue into it. I was just, you know, sort of sitting in the back of the class thinking about what the wind is doing and drawing surfboards in a notebook, and then cut to, you know, the place where I lived and started surfing in Hawaii. That felt like maybe that was my first experience outside a kind of, I mean, we lived in this white bread suburb in Los Angeles until my dad got this job and we moved when I was 13. And here suddenly I'm in a small minority racially in a very racialized situation in that school, and all this stuff's coming at me and I'm off balance, and I go on over the course of my life to spend a lot of time overseas and being a stranger in various strange lands, and this is a kind of first moment of completely fascinating to me. I mean, I was sort of in some sense, while embattled, I was also sort of finding my calling, maybe, and then I meet these guys out in the water, these Hawaiian brothers who became my best friends there, and it just felt like the right place to start the story of my life if I was going to tell the story of my life through surfing.
Right, yeah. Yeah, no, I think it makes a lot of sense because of what you said about it. You are a stranger and so much of your life, you know, went on to be you as a stranger in a strange land. And also, it was so difficult, as you describe it, that situation that you found yourself in, that the contrast of the surfing and what it gave you in your life, I imagine, perhaps took on a new element at that point than it had previously, you know, when you were back in America. I mean, not America, yeah. California. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And come to think of it, the sort of contrast back and forth in that first chapter where I'm surfing these new spots, one place in particular, Diamond Head Cliffs, that I just loved and was quite complicated and was really, you know, trying to learn, and I made friends out there. People have said to me, oh, you grew up partly in Hawaii. Oh, aren't the lineups, you know, really tough? Don't, you know, people chase you out of the water. You're some, you know, stranger. You're mainlander. You're Haole, means white. And I said, no, never. I've never had any problem in the surf in Hawaii. I still go back there a lot. And in fact, in that first chapter, I don't know anybody and I'm nervous, but nobody hassles me. And I even say, you know, nobody vibed me in the water. You know, it was the opposite of my life at school. And school was tough. You know, people were kind of jumping. I mean, I got a lot of fights and that sort of thing. Eventually joined a little gang. And so the contrast was strong back and forth between school and surfing and, you know, sort of life on land, life in the water. And it was, and a little bit counterintuitive. People, you know, expect somehow surfing in California to be tough for an outsider, but it was quite the opposite for me.
Yeah.
And also maybe have kind of soft-edged notions of how Hawaii might be socially when it can actually be quite tough. And there was an excerpt from that chapter published in The New Yorker in June that got a big reaction in Hawaii. People feeling like, oh, he's... I mean, it's my impression is I got a lot of reader mail and there's stuff written in Hawaii that, you know, I'm writing about how it really is. And that was 40 years ago. I assume it's different now. But people saying this is how it really is here and nobody ever says so.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that it's this racialized and intense in at least in the public schools. I think there are a lot of private schools that are kind of like where President Obama went. Punahou is this great prep school there that I've since come to know, but at that time didn't know anything about. You know, this kind of stuff is not so vivid. And for all I know, Kamiki Intermediate, the school I went to then, is a haven of liberal multiculturalism. Now I don't know.
It'd be interesting to find out. So you've had people giving you kudos for representing the situation honestly. I'm wondering how easy it was to be honest about yourself as you were writing the book and the various experiences you talk about in the book.
Well, it's, you know, autobiography is or memoir is a weird genre for a reporter. I mean, you end up kind of investigating your own memories, you know, sort of reporting out your own past. And it's a very, it's a sort of dicey business, you know. I mean, this is private life. It was all off the record, as reporters say. And now, you know, you take it upon yourself to give yourself license to depict all these unguarded, shared moments with friends and loved ones, usually from many years ago. That's, it's quite dicey what you include, you know. Nobody knew this was on the record. It wasn't. ends up, I end up recontacting lots of old friends and frenemies, and, you know, trying to agree about what happened, and often their memories are very different. And
interesting.
And sort of negotiating their privacy, and also deciding what about yourself, you know, all the stupid things you've done, or maybe you haven't done any, but that I've done, and you know, episodes of cruelty and things that are, you know, incredibly uncomfortable to recall, let alone tell everybody about.
Yeah.
I mean, you sort of know if you're this uncomfortable, it's probably pretty interesting. But, you know, you also have to make a lot of judgment calls about other people's involvement in these things. And are you now using their real names going to, you know, tell the world about this, or do you have a right to do that?
Yeah.
Is it right to do that? And also on yourself. On yourself, it's an easier call if you want to, you know, out yourself as a schmuck of various kinds, you're free to do so. But there's plenty of that kind of deliberation and plenty of embarrassing things in the book.
Yeah. Well, I just want to let listeners know, again, the name of the book is Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. And I want to thank you so much, William, for coming on the show. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, my pleasure, and I'm looking forward to Santa Cruz.
Yeah, so just to let listeners know again, William is going to be at the Santa Cruz Mountain Brewing Company July 28th, 7 p.m. to give a talk and sign books. It's part of Bookshop Santa Cruz series of combining a love of books with a love of beer, and you can find out more information about that event, bookshopsantacruz.com, and you can also pick up a Books and Brews passport at Bookshop Santa Cruz, or print one online, and if you get it stamped at least two events in the series, you'll be entered to win a $150 Bookshop gift card. But anyway, try and get down there to see William Finnegan. Again, that's July 28th, 7 p.m. I'll be going, so I hope to see you there. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. Remember, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear all past podcasts there. We've had some very interesting topics and also some wonderful arts guests, so I hope you'll check that out. I'll see you next week.